some group of people, thousands. So nice. Thank you very much. That's really nice. Thank you. It's great to be at Trump Tower. It's great to be in a wonderful city, New York. And it's an honor to have everybody here. This is beyond anybody's expectations. There's been no crowd like this. Thank you. It's true.
Donald Trump announcing his presidential campaign last month. That crowd he was talking to might have been filled out with some paid actors. We'll talk about the business and the ethics of renting crowds later on the show with the owner of a company that does just that. But first, school discipline. The White House is holding a summit today to look at how we deal with kids with behavior problems. According to the Department of Education, more than 3 million students are suspended or expelled every year. And non-white, disabled, and LGBT students are suspended at much higher rates than white kids. That's a problem because research has shown that taking students out of class or kicking them out of school feeds into the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. The question is, what's a better way to deal with troubled kids? The School Discipline Consensus Report recommends strategies to keep kids in school and out of the criminal justice system. It was released last year by the Council of State Governments Justice Center. Michael Thompson is the center's executive director. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with this problem, the so-called school-to-prison pipeline. Tell us about that, and what is the connection between schools and prisons?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of concern among parents and youth and other advocates across the country that there's a lot of kids who are being removed from the classroom for disciplinary reasons. And we did a really extraordinary study in the state of Texas where we followed every single youth between 7th and 12th grade through their projected graduation date. And we found that 60% of all students between 7th and 12th grade were suspended at least once. 83% of African-American boys suspended at least once, and we found 15% of all students in the state of Texas suspended 11 or more times between 7th and 12th grade. And this was not something that is unique to Texas, but is, in fact, we see happening across the country. And the analysis that we did found that when there is this removal from the school campus, it dramatically increases, triples the likelihood that that student is going to come into contact with the juvenile justice system. So,
what are they being suspended for?
Well, that's exactly it. We had thought initially maybe it was most frequently for behaviors that state law requires the student be removed from the classroom for, like bringing a gun onto campus or bringing illegal drugs onto campus. In fact, it turned out that 95% of the removals were ones done at the discretion of teachers, the overwhelming majority for which fell into the category of things like insubordination or other kinds of defiant behaviors. So we're not talking simply about what could be serious behavior like theft or vandalism, but instead cases where you have students speaking out, challenging teachers verbally, maybe getting into disruptive behaviors. Those are the kinds of things that appear to be driving the high volume of suspensions.
Wow. Well, here in Los Angeles, the public school system, LAUSD, has banned suspensions for defiance. And I think it's the first district in the nation to do that. Is that among your report's recommendations?
It is. One of the things that we definitely talk about is, what are the behaviors that actually allow for a student to be suspended, and really trying to minimize, some of the kinds of frivolous decisions maybe that prompt a removal from the classroom. But at the same time, we do have to recognize that the response to this challenge of large numbers of disciplinary removals can't simply be to ignore the behavior. We have to actually create classrooms that create productive learning environments for all students there. So it can't be just a matter of prohibiting the suspension. It also has to be about changing the climate and the learning environment in those classrooms.
And is it also about removing the police? On a lot of campuses, the police are just there. And so maybe it's easy to get them involved in a disciplinary problem.
Yeah, I think it's about sort of what's the role of police on school campus. I mean, certainly I think there's instances where everybody agrees that, you know, the a school-based police officer can provide a valuable role or function. But if that person is simply brought in to deal with, you know, a disruptive student in the classroom, the kind of thing that historically a teacher would have dealt with, that's really not a good use of a school-based police officer. You really want that person to be there to deal with the kinds of activities that you would normally have police deal with, not the kinds of activities that you'd have teachers deal with.
Okay, so what are your recommendations? How do you deal with a disruptive student?
Right. So, I mean, how do you create a better school climate, first of all? I mean, we all remember, for example, the teacher, you know, who would be screaming like crazy in the classroom and things would still be completely out of hand. We can contrast that with a teacher that we remember who could literally put the finger to their lips and achieve instant silence in the classroom. You know, these aren't just simply gifts that people have. These are skills that are cultivated. How do you teach teachers, in effect, to really be able to provide that kind of school climate? That's an example of the kind of training and then the kind of emphasis that we talk about in one section of the report.
Well, isn't one of the problems the fact that classrooms are overcrowded? Teachers are asked to do so much. And really, the most effective way they have in the moment, and maybe the most time-efficient way of doing it in the moment, is to just remove the disruptive kid from the classroom so the rest of the kids can get on with the lesson.
I mean, that's a great point. I mean, we have to be really sympathetic to teachers who, you know, are under enormous amounts of pressure. They're dealing with kids with a very diverse set of needs in a compressed time frame, with lots of kids in the classroom and wanting to achieve academically. And absolutely, you know, we can sympathize with a teacher who relies on suspension in order to manage the classroom behavior. At the same time, you know, we have to recognize we've got to provide that teacher with the tools. Many teachers aren't taught these kinds of skills about how to actually manage classroom behavior. So that's one thing. A second thing is that when there is that disruptive student, let's give that student, that teacher, tools to respond that don't involve just sending the kid home where they're going to be on Xbox all day. Maybe there's a cooling off space in the school where that student can be sent, where they will continue to be in a learning environment but not sent home for the day, which is maybe what the student wants in the first place. Those are examples of kinds of tools that we need to provide teachers to help deal with these kinds of difficulties. Situations.
But it also, doesn't it come down to fundamentally changing the approach to what is a disruptive behavior and understanding that in a different way, that maybe it's not about being bad, but about other things such as being hungry or being upset over a conversation they had on the schoolyard, but not being a bad kid trying to disrupt?
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. I mean, the first thing starts with leadership, right, where it's made clear to all the teachers. And again, you've seen some evidence of this in different school districts in California and certainly in Los Angeles, where the message is given, listen, we want every kid here to succeed, and we need to keep all kids in the classroom. And we're going to do that in part by being much more understanding about what these situations are instead of just having a hair trigger sort of mentality where we instantly remove that kid and send that kid home. So you absolutely want to create that kind of environment and also really start to, but again, provide teachers too the skills to deal with certain situations. So if a student stands up all of a sudden and decides to show off in front of other classmates and challenge a teacher's authority, that teacher doesn't want to stand in the doorway and block it from that student, where that student, thinking he's being funny, puts his hands on the teacher, and then you've got a very serious incident on your hands where you're going to have to call the police. How do you have the teacher in that incident actually stand to the side and act in a way that's respectful but actually can help change that student's behavior in that situation? That's the kind of stuff that we're trying to really help teachers learn to deal with those situations better.
So basically it comes down to educating the teacher. Is what you're saying.
Well, that's certainly one thing. I mean, one thing is leadership. Another thing is providing teachers, you know, these kinds of skills to deal with these situations, and others providing them with the kinds of tools that we were talking about, really changing the role of police. And then also providing policymakers with the data so that they can actually track what's happening. Not only are suspensions going down, for example, but at the same time, is the school climate improving? Do students and parents say, you know what, I feel better coming to school than I did last year. I feel safer. I feel people want me to learn. Those are school climate surveys that we want to be tracking.
Michael Thompson, director of the Council of State Governments Justice Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, on to another reality of the classroom, and that is testing. For the first time since 2001, both the House and the Senate have passed new versions of No Child Left Behind, two jumbo bills that, when reconciled, will set the tone for federal education policy in the United States. And you know that when we say federal education policy, we really are talking about testing and testing and more testing. How much is too much? And how does the Common Core, that new scene, how does that figure into the testing landscape? For a rundown of the No Child Left Behind makeover, testing fatigue, and Common Core, we're joined by Anya Kamenetz. She's the lead education blogger for NPR. Hi, Anya.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, No Child Left Behind was passed early on by President George W. Bush. The heart of the law, at the heart of it, is, as I said, testing once a year. I think it's every year from third to eighth grade and once in high school. This is really unprecedented, right, this amount of testing?
Well, it really is, and it's one of the things that makes it hard to kind of talk about what the classroom reality is, because we all have a tendency to refer to our own experience in school. And, you know, throughout the 20th century, there were kind of occasional sampling tests. You had the Nation's Report Card, the NAEP test. But this level of annual testing, and then, of course, as I mentioned in my story today, you know, so many of the tests that students take in school are not just the federally required tests, but they're actually required at the state and the district level, kind of piled on top of the federal mandate.
Yeah. Well, the original point of the law, which President Bush trumpeted, was to bring lower performing schools up, to have them accountable. Has that happened?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, the original architects of No Child Left Behind argue that, yes, there's been improvement. There's been some, small incremental improvements in the achievement gap. At the same time, we're still performing at a very mediocre level when you look at the international test scores and benchmarks. And we still have a very bothersome, gap in achievement between lower income and higher income students, as well as between races and ethnicities. So it certainly hasn't been a panacea as it may have been promised to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's a little confusing what Education Secretary Arne Duncan said recently about this. And he says the new version will reduce testing time in the classroom. And how's it going to do that?
Well, it's really, this kind of piqued my interest as well. The bedrock federal requirement has not changed. And that was something that was a matter of huge debate over the last, this whole reauthorization conversation. So it's still every student, it's still third through eighth grades, it's still every year, and once in high school, math and reading. But what he's referring to is the fact that the burden of testing, as I said, students, a study found last year, are being tested for 23 distinct purposes in the classroom, and that includes benchmarking, diagnostics, includes testing for the purpose of teacher evaluation. It includes, testing them to see how they're going to do on the state test, and it includes high school graduation tests that are often given with multiple retakes. So the hope is, with a couple of these amendments, they're trying to kind of get at everything else. So they said, we couldn't slay the dragon of federal testing, or that was something that was, really held up, supported by too many people. But, at least we can maybe cut back on tests that many, many people agree are redundant or unnecessary or outdated or all three.
But will these be voluntary?
Well, yeah. So the bigger theme and the bigger picture here is, a little bit of a step back from what many people grew to see over the last decade and a half is a lot of federal overreaching in education policy, a lot of top-down mandates between No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top and the Common Core, federal kind of sticks, federal carrots. So what we're not seeing here, there is no cap on testing requirements. What the amendments I'm talking about, the Michael Bennett and the Tommy Baldwin amendments, are seeking to do is sort of provide funding for states that want to audit their testing burden. So to take a look at the tests they're using, to figure out how much money they're spending, how much time they're taking, how long it takes for the results to come out, and whether they're actually useful. And then in the Bennett Amendment as well, it says, that a state should voluntarily set a cap on the total instructional time that they're taking up with assessments, and that the districts then should have to communicate with parents if they want to exceed that cap.
All right. It's all very confusing. Just to confuse everyone further, I'm going to introduce the idea of Common Core. How does this play into all of this testing and No Child Left Behind?
Right. So it is really a morass, and it's kind of hard to pick up one thread without touching everything else. So the Common Core are learning standards. They're standards for what students should know and be able to do. They're not technically a federal initiative. Race to the Top did encourage most states to adopt them. About 43 states currently are using the Common Core. And the consensus seems to be that the Common Core is here to stay. You know, there's been so much whiplash, and there's really a lot of sunk costs now for a lot of states that, you know, adopted the tests or training teachers over the course of this summer to use the Common Core. But, you know, the real discontent and disquiet is coming around, where the rubber really meets the road with these learning standards is, again, with standardized testing. And so in states like New York, you know, on the one hand, you see a very strong opt-out movement, so many students not taking the tests that there's a question about whether or not the results are really going to be reliable. And so implementation is kind of at a standstill there. On the other hand, there are some states like Kentucky that are adopting the Common Core and doing really, really well with it by all measures. So, you know, these learning standards, there's obviously going to be transition time and transition period that makes people, it's hard for people to deal with. There's various different objections that come out. But, you know, after that adjustment period has gone on, I think that there's going to be maybe more of a reconciliation to what is with rather than, you know, and some inertia as well.
Hmm. Well, can you have Common Core without the testing? Can you just teach these Common Cores without testing the students to see if they've picked them up?
Well, absolutely, in theory. I mean, you know, we've been so tied to this kind of measurement or this system of accountability and measurement and assessing outcomes. Common Core and the standardized test, the high stakes test, really seem to arrive as one package. But obviously, I mean, it's impossible to imagine a program for improving schools that doesn't entirely rely on tests. If you look more at things like teacher preparation or exactly what you were just talking about in your last segment about, you know, improving what goes on inside schools, improving disciplinary tactics and improving inclusiveness so that, you know, students of all various abilities or whatever they're dealing with at home have more opportunities to learn. That's really like a whole entire other tactic to take. And I actually think one of the most hopeful signs, you know, is to look beyond simply using academic tests or any kind of standardized tests to determine what's going on in school and what we should be praising and blaming, but actually instead looking at other kinds of indicators and measures that might be equally telling, for example, disciplinary records and behavior records and attendance records in schools.
Yeah. Well, I guess the problem is that funding is attached to testing and test scores. And also, parents use the test scores to assess whether or not to send their kids to a particular school if they have the choice.
Well, that's very, very true. You know, we kind of live in a world that is all about big data. It's all about numbers. And many massive decisions are made on the basis of these test scores. I've seen a lot of kind of amusing or not so amusing reports about the relationship between test scores and real estate values, to the point where in certain school districts in New York, for example, they train the real estate agents to talk about the local test scores because that's such a big indicator of where a family is going to choose if they have the means. So this is a major lever for decision making of all kinds across our society. And, you know, it's only going to stop, I think, when there's more kinds of information and perhaps better kinds of information that we can use to make decisions.
Anya Kamenetz, lead education blogger for NPR, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And we'd like to hear from you. How do you and your children deal with school testing? Are you on board with testing? Do you wish that schools would dial it back a bit, get rid of it entirely? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tell us what you think on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, teen pregnancies are down, and that's because teens are not having as much sex as they were a generation ago. They're also using the morning after pill a lot. That story is next on Press Play.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. American teenagers are waiting longer to have sex. Less than half of teens report having sex, according to a new study out today from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Add that to recent studies that show teen pregnancy is on the decline, and it looks like we have a trend. Until perhaps you drill down a bit into the numbers and how they play out here in LA. For instance, when compared to the national numbers, there are more teen pregnancies among poor girls and Latina and Black girls here in LA. Here to discuss both the national picture and what's going on in Los Angeles is Julie Cederbaum, a professor at the USC School of Social Work. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, sex rates for teens have been declining since 1991. So for a while, how come?
I think partly this is related to sex education, particularly in schools, and that's been a real driver in the decline of teen sex rate. And I think that the start of that really came with the identification of HIV, particularly when we became to know that it was sexually transmitted, that sex education really changed and schools became kind of the heart of where sexual education was happening.
Even though there have been many battles on whether or not there should be sex education, some schools have gotten rid of it, especially in the South.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think we are really lucky in California to be in a state with comprehensive sexual education. All schools have some sex education. The difference becomes abstinence only versus comprehensive sexual education. I think that that is why we see higher rates of teen pregnancy in the South, though, than states like California.
Well, something not on the decline, the use of the morning after pill. And statistics, one in five teen girls report using the morning after pill, which is extraordinary. So 20%.
You know, this statistic was a little harder to pinpoint a clear answer for. My guess is that the increase in access to options like Plan B or the morning after pill, which was made accessible over the counter in June of 2013 by the FDA for women of all ages, is probably what has influenced this rise. And while use of Plan B or morning after contraceptives among teens, I think, may alarm some, and my hope, obviously, is that teens would use condoms or other pregnancy prevention methods prior to having sex. Teens who are having unprotected sex now have access to a contraceptive method that will decrease teen birth and abortion rates. And I think that if it is a startling number, but it is also an indication that teens are aware that pregnancy and parenting isn't, their best course.
Has that happened? Has there been a related decline in abortions and pregnancies?
We don't have the statistics yet because the access only is, about 2 years old.
Okay.
And so we'll have to see over the coming years if that's true. But my guess is that we'll continue to see those declines because now people have the opportunity. The difficulty will be in capturing rates because the use of Plan B lends to you never being pregnant, or if you became pregnant, kind of termination of that, that's the wrong word, but the pregnancy not being able to come to fruition, and so it'll be hard to know if the statistics can capture the numbers.
Right, I understand what you're saying. So, but I did notice that there's a decline in the use of the pill. I wonder if the teen girls are swapping that out.
Yeah, that is surprising and a little frightening for me. And I wonder how much of that is an access issue and how much of that is kind of a trend issue. And so it'll be interesting to watch as in the American Academy of Pediatrics just last year in September decided that IUD was, a recommendation for teens. And so I wonder if we'll continue to see declines in things like the pill because of an increase in other methods like IUDs.
Okay, so how do all these statistics play out here in Los Angeles?
So compared to the national average, our teen pregnancy and birth rate is higher. But it is not higher than the state of California and is much lower as compared to rural counties in our state. I think that we still see, and this is related to trends that you kind of said at the top of the segment, which is that counties with the highest socioeconomic status have the lowest number of teen births. And it may be that those kids are less likely to have sex. It may be that those kids are more likely to have access to contraception, or they may have more access to abortion. It's hard to kind of always know why that is, but it seems that poverty, immigration, and acculturation all kind of play a role in teen pregnancy.
Right. And something like the morning after pill, it's not cheap.
No, and so there's a real access issue there as well. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you study the foster care system in Los Angeles, and I imagine that there's a different statistic there for teen sex rates and pregnancy rates.
Yeah, you know, what's been interesting about kids in the child protection system is that even if they haven't been substantiated for maltreatment, their rates are higher for teen pregnancy. And so I think that's that family instability, it's maybe trauma, abuse, that really seems to be a driver, that when kind of your home life is chaotic, there's other factors, maybe you look to others for kind of the support that you need. And in that, sometimes there's an association with increased pregnancy and birth rates. But in foster care, we do see slightly higher numbers, although the overall numbers are not terribly high. And this trend is higher among Black and Latina girls.
And the trend of actually having, of getting
birth.
Pregnant and getting birth.
Giving birth, yeah.
Right. So what about getting pregnant and terminating the pregnancy?
Those numbers are less clearly captured. We know that on the state level, I don't have the information for LA County. On the state level, we found recently in a paper we published that abortion rates were higher among girls who had had contact with the child welfare system. So that wasn't foster care specifically, but that these teens are getting pregnant. It's an indication that they're getting pregnant at higher rates than mm-hmm. the general population.
Right. And so there could be a variety of reasons, as you indicated earlier. Is it a knowledge issue, or is it something that maybe unconsciously they're trying to create a family that they didn't have?
I think you make a great point. There is some statistics that, or some literature that does show that kind of creating a family, a stable family of one's own, may be a driver for why some pregnancy among teens is planned, but most teen pregnancy is unplanned. And there are kind of a number of contextual factors that kind of influence that. The confluence ends up being kind of your personal or individual kind of beliefs about contraceptive use or your, like you said, attitudes towards childbearing. Others can be family-related, family history. So history of, if you have a mom that was a teen parent, you're more likely to be a teen parent. Parent income and education is a real predictor of teen pregnancy, as are parents' expectations. So do I expect you to go to college? Do I expect you, you know, kind of future orientation? And then communication, sex, you know, communication about abstinence and safer sex from family. And then you have kind of partner, you know, factors, which include your partner's attitudes towards contraceptive use, age discordance. So sometimes teen girls are having sex with men who are a number of years older, and so kind of power dynamics and negotiation skills, and then their ability to communicate about what they need. So mm-hmm. whether they want to use a condom even when he does not want to. And then we have the society factors, which are access to healthcare services. You know, we know neighborhood safety, community norms, and education and career opportunities all factor into teen pregnancy.
Julie Cederbaum teaches at USC School of Social Work. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in the program, why was Sandra Bland arrested after making a minor traffic violation? Would a white woman have been arrested or even pulled over in the first place? We like to think our criminal justice system is unbiased, but the author of a new book says it's unfair from the police to the judges to the jury. His idea is to make it fair later on in the show. Also,
we give you all the perks of being a celebrity without the negatives.
The business of crowds for hire, all that is coming up after a news update with Jennifer Wolf.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said, get
failure?
Out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're threatening to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
Wow.
Get out of the car.
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a
over there.
Sandra Bland was pulled over by a Texas trooper for failing to signal a lane change. She later died in her jail cell, and her death is being investigated. A police dash cam video released yesterday shows the increasingly hostile encounter the young African-American woman from Chicago had recently moved to Texas for a new job. Would the officer have pulled her over if she were white? Would he have threatened to drag her out of the car and light her up? Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice is a new book by Drexel University law professor Adam Benferrato. In it, he discusses the subconscious biases that most of us have, biases we're not even aware of, but that can be measured scientifically. And these biases, he writes, undermine every stage of our justice system, from police to prosecutors, judges, and juries. Adam Benferrato is here now. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
Well, we don't know anything about the officer in this particular case involving Sandra Bland, but as a general question, officers, you know, a lot of discussion has been had lately about officers and their relation to black suspects. Do you think that they are operating on an unconscious bias?
I think many of them are, and I think that that process doesn't fit with our conventional narratives about police brutality. We tend to think that it must always originate with a bigot, someone who's acting based on racial animus. And I think the research from psychology, which has been done on implicit social cognition, suggests that actually well-intentioned, egalitarian-minded people can actually act based on damaging stereotypes that are pervasive in our society that link the concept of blackness and crime, violence, threat. And so many of these incidents, I think, recently may have their origins actually in people who are trying to do their best, who are acting under extreme stress and rely on automatic processes which tell them how to react in situations where they don't have a lot of time to think. And one of those cues is the color of someone's skin. Now, again, in this case, I don't know if that was the process at work, but I certainly think that may explain a lot of what we've been seeing over the last few months.
Right. And so then once we get into the courtroom, does that continue those biases when we're talking about a judge who is, you know, admittedly not involved in a very emotional hair trigger situation as that officer we heard was involved in? Are there similar biases involved?
Yes, there definitely are. And these have been documented both in the laboratory and in the real world in terms of implicit racial bias affecting judges. And that's not terribly surprising because where implicit racial bias comes from is our culture. And we're all exposed to the same television shows that depict young African-American men in a certain way. We watch the same 5 o'clock news programs which show young African-American men linked to crime. And so it's not surprising at all that judges are also influenced.
Juries as well, I assume.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so you write that they're not just biased by someone, the color of someone's skin, but also whether or not that person is fat or thin, attractive or unattractive.
Absolutely. And so we know that a lot of us, you know, our world is in a very complex place. And so we look for mental shortcuts to make it simpler. And that may be the color of someone's skin, how heavy they are, whether they're attractive. More attractive witnesses, for example, are more likely to be believed.
And then also you cite research that shows judges are more likely to grant parole in a hearing held early in the morning than before they're about to take a break. I mean, it
yeah,
seems like such a seemingly minor, trivial thing, and yet it has such a grave importance.
Yeah. So we tend to, in the United States, think there are two kinds of judges. There are umpire judges who just call balls and strikes, who are objective. And then there are activist judges who are looking to advance their own agendas. And what the research suggests is that all judges are subject to countless biases, and many beyond their conscious awareness or control, one of those being simply the time of day. So researchers in Israel were interested in the question of whether someone is granted parole. What are the factors that determine that? I would have told you I teach criminal law. I would have told you it was the severity of the crime they committed and how they did in prison, whether they reformed themselves. But what the researchers found was it was the time of day that was largely determining things. And coming first thing in the morning was a really, really good time if you were looking to be granted parole. Right before the first break in the day, that was a very, very bad time.
I'm speaking with Adam Benferrato. He's a law professor at Drexel University, and he has a new book out. It's called Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Well, certainly in other countries, there are similar biases at work in their own criminal justice systems, but we don't see nearly the rate of incarceration in other countries as we see here. So if it could it be that if we just changed our laws, our sentencing laws, and especially involving drugs, that a lot of these biases could be, well, erased, or at least the effect, not erased, but the effects of them could be erased. There would be fewer people locked up.
Absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of wrongful convictions could be avoided, and incidents like the one involving Sandra Bland could be avoided if we didn't arrest and pull over so many people. So I think that is a great way, actually, to cut down on a lot of the psychological biases that I focus on. Now, in terms of, you know, how we go about doing that, I think we're going to have to adopt a new sort of mindset when it comes to what the purpose of our correctional system is all about. I think it's largely driven by retribution, this basic desire for payback right now. And I think other countries, particularly those in Northern Europe, have realized that in order to make a safer place, in order to ensure that actually people we lock up are able to be successful later, a public health model is a lot more successful.
Now, what about body cameras for police officers or dash cams in police cruisers? There was that camera in the Sandra Bland arrest. It doesn't seem to have affected the officer's behavior, though.
Yeah. So one of the things that we know about cameras is they can be helpful in leading officers to conform their behavior, to think a little bit more before they act. So there are positive benefits of cameras. It does not appear to have had a big influence in this particular case, but we know from research that it can have that impact. The thing that worries me about the broad move across the country in the wake of all of these incidents over the last several months involving police officers and young African Americans is that we sort of believe that cameras offer a neutral perspective on events. And as soon as we have a camera footage, we know exactly what happened. And what the latest research suggests is that cameras can actually be powerfully biasing. So in some of this research, they looked at the interrogation situation and they put a camera behind the detective and they put a camera behind the person being interrogated. And again, that shouldn't matter at all. It's the same events after all. But when the researchers showed participants these different videos, the participants ended up reaching very different conclusions about whether this particular confession was voluntary or not. When they looked at things from the perspective of the detective, they tended to think, well, this is an uncoerced voluntary confession. It can come in as evidence. But when they looked at things through the perspective of the suspect, suddenly they started to notice all of these coercive elements, and they were far more likely to say, wait a second, actually, this is a coerced interrogation. It can't come before a jury.
So, you know, it's funny that we're trying to rely on things that we think are unbiased, cameras, for example, DNA evidence, fingerprinting, these kinds of things we see as scientific evidence for or against someone's guilt. And yet you're saying that they're compromised. Is there anything we can rely on?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of, you know, forensic evidence, our television show CSI, foremost among them, suggest that this is sort of the cut and dry part of a case. You know, when you have a fingerprint match, that's it. You know, no room for bias there, and certainly no room for bias when, say, we have, you know, DNA evidence. But what the research suggests is that confirmation bias can actually corrupt the work of lab technicians. So when a lab technician, for instance, knows already that the particular fingerprint that she is looking at comes from someone who has confessed or comes from someone who an eyewitness has already ID'd, she's significantly more likely to find that fingerprint as a match in the case. And so I think that we need to look broadly at ways we can address confirmation bias problems. One of the best ways actually comes from, you know, laboratory research, which is that the person conducting the experiment, or in this case, doing the match, shouldn't know what the desired outcome is. And I think there are ways, and certainly certain jurisdictions are already looking at ways to do blind testing. And I think that's the way we should go.
You also have an idea to have a virtual courtroom where the people in the courtroom, the defendant, maybe the lawyer, would be replaced by avatars to reduce any bias on the part of the jury.
Yeah, and I think this is, you know, I think we always have to be looking not only at solutions we can do right now. So blind testing, that's something we could do in jurisdictions around the country right now. We also have to be thinking 50, 100, 200 years down the line. And I think one thing that we ought to think about is more controlled spaces of adjudication. If it matters the color of the skin of the defendant, if you know, jurors focus on whether a witness is making eye contact in order to determine whether that witness is lying, the evidence suggests that's a very bad way to tell whether someone is telling the truth or not. If these physical cues are biasing our legal decision makers, we need to find ways to control that. And so my thought here is that at some point we should move to a virtual environment in which all of these different biases can be better controlled.
Is anyone taking you up on that?
So it's interesting. I have been hearing from judges. I've been hearing from police officers. I've been hearing from, you know, I did a talk in California a couple weeks ago at the Commonwealth Club. There was a forensic technician there. And I have found, I mean, I was actually very surprised when I started writing this book, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. It wasn't this moment of interest in reform. I think people are very interested in reform and very interested in thinking more broadly about what we can possibly do about the biases that we're experiencing. I think, you know, virtual courtrooms, that's something that isn't on the agenda. We need to do a lot more research before we're there. But in terms of reforms with eyewitness identifications, with how we conduct our interrogations, those things I think are very much on the table today.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
It was a pleasure.
That's Adam Benferrato. He's a law professor at Drexel University and author of the new book, Unfair: The New Science of Criminal Injustice. Coming up, fake crowds at political events. Donald Trump may have hired actors to cheer during his presidential announcement, but it's not just Trump. That's next on Press Play.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You heard a bit of Donald Trump's presidential announcement at the top of the show today. Last month, The Hollywood Reporter published evidence that many of the supporters cheering him may, in fact, have been paid actors. Trump has denied that, but he wouldn't be the only political candidate who has used crowds for hire. In fact, it's somewhat of a booming business. Adam Swart is the CEO of Crowds on Demand, a company based here in L.A. that provides rental crowds, and he has filled rooms for many political events. He's here now. Hi.
Hi. Pleasure to be on the program.
Well, nice to have you. Tell us about the kinds of events that you fill a room for.
Sure. Well, it's really every kind of event, and it's not always political either. I mean, certainly any kind of political event, issue advocacy, campaign rally, campaign protest, of course. But also we're looking at, you know, when it's a celebrity who has to fill a room, whether it's when it's a company that has to fill a room, whether it's somebody who wants to do something a little more ambitious than that and really do a flash mob or PR stunt, really anything to really get attention for yourself, but get the right attention for yourself and really frame the perception well. And that's what we really specialize in.
What is the weirdest or most interesting gig that you've done?
Well, we don't discuss our clients, so I really couldn't tell you. But I mean, safe to say, most of what you'd expect would happen has certainly happened with us. You know, we've had, you know, we've worked with very, you know, interesting individuals, companies, campaigns, you know, folks from all walks of life. And it's extremely interesting.
Well, how much of your work is political?
Quite a bit. You know, it's hard to say exactly the percentage, but, you know, quite a bit of our work is political. But it's not always for candidates either, though, because people think, okay, rent a crowd, well, it's only for candidates. Well, a lot of our biggest you know, our biggest clients are actually people who are advocating for one or another side of the issues, because those groups also don't have to report things as much in terms of, you know, campaign contributions. So, you know, a lot of issue advocacy groups use us a lot. So,
well, yeah, the Atlantic says that you were paid $50,000 or more by the Six Californias campaign to split the state into six independent states.
Well, I think what I would say is that we really have clients from, you know, very diverse backgrounds. And I think that's one of the most interesting parts of running a business like this, is you really get to interact with such an interesting array of people and of ideas.
Is it on one particular side of the aisle or the other?
No, we're not political. Now what I can say is that we don't work with hate groups. But we're not Republican or we're not Democratic, you know.
I mean, who contacts you? Like, who's more likely to contact you?
Well, we work with both parties, and we actually work with a lot of issues that aren't really partisan issues at all. Because I think what people forget oftentimes is most issues aren't actually partisan. We work on a lot of local issues, for example, like, you know, whether or not a city should close the bars earlier or later. We might take one side of that issue. Or in terms of getting city council approval of a property development, you know, we'll stack the public comments with our own folks who are basically giving comments in favor.
You mean online or is that what you're talking about? You do that as well?
Well, online, but also in person, you know. So say you have a public comment hearing, we basically will provide the people to make the public comment.
How do you feel? I know you were a political science major at UCLA. How do you feel about manipulating the political process this way?
Well, I really disagree that it's in any way manipulating. I mean, if you look at negative ads that run on TV or even positive ads that these candidates run, those are the most misleading part of politics. Or, you know, have you seen these flyers and leaflets that you get on your doorstep that are saying something or another about this candidate or that candidate, most of which are either half-truths or even completely false? But those things, you know, those are really the big culprits in terms of misleading people. You know, we're really a part of engaging people in the political process. My goal is to stimulate discourse and stimulate the discussion. You know, we're not manipulators, you know, like folks who do those misleading
acts. But you're hired by one side of an issue to stack the deck in favor of that side's position. So that is, in effect, manipulating the process, because it's not an organic opposition for a particular idea. It's paid for and staffed by you.
Well, but let me put it in a different context, though. Say you see a lot of people on one side of the issue, it really stimulates the discourse. You see a rally, you see a protest, it really gets people thinking critically about the issue. Merely seeing people isn't going to, in and of itself, turn perception. It's going to get people to think critically.
But it also may give the impression that there is opposition to something that doesn't exist, that there, in fact, may not be opposition to something.
Well, it really starts stimulating the discourse, is what I always say. And that's, you know, the real positive impact. I mean, what I would question is, how is it different, or how, you know, it's actually far more democratic than a lot of, you know, negative television commercials. You know, I can go spend $100 million and bombard the airwaves with negative television commercials about something, and that's definitely, you know, making it seem like there's a whole opposition when there's not. Mm-hmm. And it's much more manipulative than what I do, which is much more kind of organic grassroots initiatives that are really helping people think about the issue in a different context and really promoting our talking points rather than kind of bombarding the airwaves and not allowing people breathing room when they're trying to, you know, watch TV or listen into the radio.
And who do you hire for your events?
Sure. Well, basically, we use actors, activists, all kinds of folks, really. Basically, people who are really engaged, you know,
Do you pay them?
And enthusiastic. Oh, when we're working, yes, of course, yes, we do pay people.
How much do you pay them?
Well, it really depends, and a lot of times, what happens is that we'll start, we'll kind of be the seed. You know, so say I have a protest, I'll put, you know, 10, 15 people in a protest, but often far more than that will then see that and join. And that's what I mean about encouraging the democratic process, because say you see a group of 10 people protesting, some people will come and join in who aren't paid, but just because they see it and they're like, wow, this is really resonating with me. So you see why I'm actually stimulating the democratic process rather than hurting it. It's because basically we're the seed that gets people talking about stuff. So my 10 people ends up growing to 100 oftentimes, especially when you're talking about an issue that's very salient.
All right. Adam Swart, CEO of Crowds on Demand. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be on the program.
All right, Julie Myers, I imagine our listeners have a lot to say about that, so I'll just cut to the chase. Our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play.
And I will look forward to seeing your responses to that. I want to hire a crowd that cheers for me every time I get up on time. Do you think that's a worthy investment?
Your theme song is the applause.
I guess
that
is.
You get that every day.
Okay, so we talked about school discipline today, and we talked about how to do it better, how to prevent incidents that happen at school from ruining kids' lives. And this is a very serious topic, but our listeners, as they are wont to do, had a little fun with it. We asked them about their memories from of school discipline from when they were kids. Michael Flanagan on Facebook says that the upshot of his experience in school boils down to this. You don't scare me. I was taught by nuns. So that's his experience. And Jessica Rufino says that she was forced to write with a magical quill that carved teacher-ordered words into her hand because apparently she went to Hogwarts.
Okay.
You'll recall.
Of course. Of course. All right. If you want to weigh in on anything you've heard on the show, our Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Again, Twitter, at KCRW Press Play. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. Warren Olney, and To the Point, up next in a few seconds from now. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.